This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
We have an author today who has written so many books and so many pieces of electronic communication with recordings and so many things in between. But the book that we're primarily concentrating on is something that kind of has to do with our relationship, yours and mine. And you listen, and we thank you for that. But it wouldn't do us really any good to be here in our headquarters studio for the Star Worldwide Networks in Phoenix, Arizona, if we weren't more together than alone. In fact, if we were alone, we probably wouldn't have lasted past the first broadcast. And now we're going into our 18th, and we're doing it in a very special way. Because More Together Than Alone is the book that we're looking at, and the existence of all of us as described that way. Subtitled, Discovering the Power and Spirit of Community in Our Lives and in the World, and that written by New York Times best-selling author Mark Nepo. Delighted, particularly after having read your book, delighted, Mark, to have you on The God Show. Hello.
Hello. Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here with you. I so appreciate it.
You talk about the power of community, but doesn't it seem that most of us are more isolated than we have been, at least in recent memory?
Well, I think that, you know, in order to, and we'll go right into some of that, you know, I think that I've been looking at this. It took me 13 years to retrieve this book, I like to say, more than author it. And in looking at patterns throughout history and different cultures, we have always, as human beings, gone through, imagine waves in the ocean. We've gone through long waves where we've come together and long waves where we've pushed each other away. And then when we've come back together. And so, you know, right now, and often those things are always happening at the same time. So one of the reasons that I was so compelled to gather this book is that underneath the discord, underneath the isolation, the fear, and yes, even the violence, there is always, it seems, and I think all this work I tried to do affirms it, that there is always a deeper, more lasting lineage of interdependence and care. And it's always much quieter. You know, one of the things I kind of discovered was, I think that if you talk about it, kind of like laws of spiritual physics, if you will, that things are always coming together and falling apart at the same time. But when things fall apart, they make a lot of noise. And when things come together, they're quieter. And in the modern global age, I believe that we have become addicted to the noise of things falling apart.
Have you? Have you not? I'm just following up that thought.
Yes.
Have you not said that, despite the hardships that you say are always present, you contend that we are more together than alone? Now, do you mean?
Yes.
Do you mean as a civilization over a long period of time, or do you mean now in this period?
I mean both. I mean both, and I think that one of the reasons why it's unclear right now to me which way this is going in our age, whether we're going to a time when we come together or a time when we push each other away, is one of the reasons is because of the things coming apart grabs all the attention and takes up so much noise and space that we don't need a good news station. We need a whole, WHOLE, news station, because it's the resilience and the resources and the divinity that's embedded in those quieter ways that things come together that heal us. And so, yes, we will, you know, things in nature will break apart. How we break each other, we add to that. And that's when I think when we're driven by fear, you know, the old choices between love and fear that exist every day and throughout history. So I do believe in the long haul, we will always get up one more time than we fall down. We'll always reach out one more time than we back away. And I also believe in this era. And so let's look at it this way. You know, when we go back into the Middle Ages, which we know as the Dark Ages, and that was in Europe. It was 200-300 year period before the Renaissance. Well, interestingly, around the rest of the world and other cultures, it was actually quite an enlightened time. But in our Western kind of predominant education, we think of it as the Dark Ages because in Europe, all learning was stalled, and it was a very difficult, dark time. Well, during those 200 to 300 years, only 10% of the European population was literate. That means 10% of the population of Europe kept literacy alive for 300 years. And I would say that if, and I'm not convinced we are, but if we are in a dark time, entering one, a tense time, a strident time, despite all of the technological advances, then it's incumbent on each of us to keep the literacy of the heart alive.
Do you contend that historically this is a pattern that is consistent throughout all of our existences?
I do. And I don't think it's a necessarily readable pattern. I don't know that it appears the same combination, or you can't say, oh, every 100 years, but definitely these elements keep repeating throughout the human story. And so let me back up. There's a chapter you in there, I'm sure you in the beginning you recall the two tribes.
And yes.
Yeah, so let me talk about how we, if we look at this pattern throughout history, if we go all the way back, it made me think, if we go all the way back to the first two human beings who ever came upon each other, until they came upon each other, they thought they were all alone. And imagine one person, man or woman, comes to the mouth of a cave, and they see another, and they go, oh my God, I thought I was alone. Who are you? What are you? And imagine the one in the cave looks at his other and says, you're different, go away. And I think that was the beginning of the go away tribe. And depending on how much fear dominates our being and our existence, then there are periods in history we can look at where members of the go away tribe have said, you know what, I can't trust you'll go away. I have to put you where I can watch you. So I'll put you on a reservation or in a ghetto or a detention center or a refugee camp. And when fear has been metastasized so darkly that it dominates our entire being, then we've had these horrible periods of genocide where, you know, the people of the go away tribe have said, I can't trust you'll be where I put you. I have to make you go away. But if we go all the way back to that cave, and now we look at the person at the mouth of the cave who sees their other, and they say, oh, you're different, come teach me. That was the beginning of the come teach me tribe. And based on the sense, the innate sense, loving sense that, oh, thank God you're not me. We are more together than alone. Let's share what we know. Let's learn from each other. And that, when that has dominated our being and our journey and our story, then that has led to the highest moments of inspiration and civilization. You know, you look at the Iberian Peninsula centered in Spain, where for 750 years, you know, from 750 to roughly when Columbus sailed for America, that was, a civilization where Muslims, Jews and Christians not only tolerated each other, they thrived together. They created unprecedented unbelievable achievements of community and civilization. So, but the catch is that we belong to both tribes. And as committed as I am to you in my heart that I'm a part of the Come Teach Me tribe, we could get off after this call and something traumatic could happen to me where I'm thrown into such a state of fear that I'll switch tribes. And then I need you to remind me. We need each other to remind us, no, we're not. No, no. Okay, we were afraid and we felt like we needed to protect ourselves. But no, we are more together than alone. Come back.
The tribe back. Chapter, the tribe chapter, Mark, I thought of as I was reading it as being an extraordinary history lesson back to the furthest reaches of history, but reminding us about those things. And I was also reminded that as people will, as they are inclined to do, say, this is the most volcanic, unpredictable period of time ever in our history. Never has anything happened quite like this. And I was thinking, well, wait a minute. I haven't been around that long. However, I so vividly remember that period of time of the Vietnam War when college administration yeah. buildings were being taken over and the unrest that existed simply about the Vietnam War, much less all of the other social problems that were going on, created an attitude among so many that that was the most volatile time that ever existed.
Well, and the challenge for each, you know, I have humbly, you know, in my life, you know, I've come to feel that, you know, wisdom doesn't help us shortcut this incarnation. It only supports our turn. No matter how much we learn, no matter how much we grow, no one, every generation, every person, every spirit, you know, in a body on time on earth has to go through this incarnation and the seminal thresholds that being here presents to us. And history supports us in that. Wisdom supports us in that. There are no shortcuts. And one of the other paradoxes under all of this, I feel, is that we are they. There is no they. There is no that. No matter how, you know, I you know, as I am, as we talked before we came on, that, you know, I'm of Jewish heritage, and but I'm a student of all paths spiritually. And we can talk more about that. But heritage-wise, I feel a great tie to the Jewish tradition. And I had members of my grandparents' generation die in the Holocaust. So how am I, as a member of the Come Teach Me tribe, at least today, what am I supposed to do with the fact that there are Nazis in the streets of America? You know, how am I supposed to? And yet, spiritually, under that, I have to ask, say, you know, like a prayer, we are they. We are they. There is no they. How do we find the, how do we pull back under the positions, under the convictions, to the central journey that we share? You know, Longfellow, the American poet Longfellow, had said that, you know, if we truly asked about our enemies' suffering, they would no longer be our enemies.
That's something that I want to remember. I by the way, in remembering the periods of unrest, marching in the streets, great violence, Vietnam, where a couple of wars before that, one ended with the bombing of Nagasaki. And you have quite a reflection on that community as an example of what can be done.
Oh, the resilience. Well, there are two amazing stories. You know, one is the incredible power of resilience of the human spirit. And, you know, that after in Nagasaki, you know, the bells of Nagasaki, there was a cathedral there that was decimated, of course. Everything was dead. The miracle was that anything was still standing. And there was this cracked bell that was left. Everything else was totally destroyed. So many people had died. And those who were still alive were struggling. And they didn't know yet, you know, imagine from their perspective, they didn't know it was one bomb and done. They didn't know that it was safe to come out.
Yes.
They didn't know that it was, even if they could come, I mean, people were so, so horribly hurt that, you know, we're not talking about coming out like you and I walking out to the mailbox. You know, people were crawling and it was awful. And there was a man who began by having the courage to come out into the daylight and seeing that at least for the moment it was safe, he managed to crawl himself and ring that cracked bell to signal to everyone that, okay, we got to do what we can now to find each other and be more together than alone and rebuild whatever we can, whatever this was that did this to us. And so every day, you know, after Nagasaki was bombed, those who remained, you know, it became an unspoken. How does that happen, right? How do we know, you know, one person did that and then somebody else crawled and did it the next day? So that every day the bell of Nagasaki was struck to signal to people that you're not alone and we've got to come out and we've got to find a way. And, you know, it's quite remarkable. Now, on the other side of that, there's another story I tell that I learned, which is quite remarkable. So we now fast forward into the, you know, the 1990s in Northwest, you know, like Utah, Montana, in the United States, and it appears that there's a Native American tribe, Sotugate, in that area, and their fathers, you know, during the 40s, their fathers who were needed money for the tribe, and so they signed up to do very hard mining work for the U.S. government in the 40s, early 40s. And it turned out, as time went on, that every one of those elders, each one of them died of cancer. And it wasn't discovered till the 90s by the children of those elders who were now elders in the 90s, when it was discovered and admitted by the government that they had, without their knowledge, they were mining uranium that was used for the bomb, to make the bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And upon learning this, and it just, you know, brings tears to me, upon learning this, the sons of those elders, at their own cost, six of them, in 1998, flew to Japan, to the city of Nagasaki, to apologize to the city for the part that their elders unknowingly played in making that bomb.
Wow. Wow. And yeah, those stories, though, as you've told them so eloquently, here and in your book, Mark Nepo, the book More Together Than Alone, and it's filled with stories. There are spiritually moving books, and you hear about many of them as we have conversations with the authors that wrote them. You hear about so many of them on The God Show, and it's that rare book indeed that depends on the magic of stories and storytelling. And we so appreciate how many of them are in More Together Than Alone. Once again, I remind everybody that it's Mark Nepo, N-E-P-O, the New York Times bestselling author of The Book of Awakening. Give us a paragraph on that book.
Well, that book, and this will tie back into the community book, that book, which came out in 2000, it's a spiritual day book. So there's an entry for every day of the year, which begins with a quote from another teacher or source, and then has an invitation for a reflection, meditation, or exercise with every day. And out of, you know, I'm a long term. I'm 68. I just turned 68 a few months ago. But in my 30s, you know, I had a rare form of lymphoma and almost died, And so blessed to be here, you know, on the other side of that. And I have a lot of people in my life who are the children of alcoholics or recovering alcoholics in the program. And so I started to see, you know, day books everywhere, you know, like in those communities, whether it's narcotics or whatever those groups are. There's a whole, so many different ones now that support people struggling, yes, with whatever it might be. Well, those things were used, you know, I mean, you found them in cars and back pockets and knapsacks, you know, on picnic tables. And so it occurred to me that this is a modern form, spiritual form, this daybook form. And if, and on the other side of almost dying, you know, I felt like if I could fill this form with small doses of what matter, or one a day, I might be able to give back in a way. And so that's how I started to do that, create that book. And it came out in 2000. And wonderfully in 2010, Oprah kindly discovered it and supported it, and the rest, as they say, is history. It went all over the world, and actually next year we'll be publishing a 20th anniversary edition, which it's hard for me to believe it's 20 years.
And you spent quite a bit of time with Oprah.
Yes, it was a blessing, just a blessing. As we were talking, she is a remarkable bridger, an amazing spirit and teacher in her own right.
But with this book, More Together Than Alone, and you concentrate, as I said, with so many stories about the power and spirit of community. Is that another way of saying it takes a village?
Absolutely. It takes it. This is the central, paradox, of course, in life, is that no one who's ever been here, who's been you or me or who's listening, and so no one can live your life, see what you see, feel what you feel, struggle with what you struggle with, wonder at what you wonder at. And the other side is that no one can do it alone. No one can do it alone. I think that life has been made just difficult enough that we need each other to ensure the journey of love. And if there's one thing, Pat, in that through all, one kind of theme, if you will, that through all these stories and all these different cultures that I've come through, it's that when fear makes us think that self-interest will protect us, mm-hmm, love and suffering affirm that we're more together than alone.
All right, now here's the challenge. I'm sure that Oprah offered you many. I don't know that Oprah offered you any quite as difficult as this. So having read the book and having just heard that phrase and reflecting now on the book that I'm looking at, More Together Than Alone, convince Congress of that right now. You're appearing, you're at the podium, the joint gathering of Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and they are yours, Mark Nepo.
I can't convince anyone. I can't convince anyone. And then this is the humble thing about being here. You know, the only thing, and I go back to my cancer journey, the only thing that opens us to each other is great love and great suffering. And you can't, you've probably heard the thing, you know, that the old story of someone who saw a butterfly struggling to come out of its cocoon, and so it breathed on it, it warmed it, it wanted to help it be birthed. And in fact, it wound up killing it, because nobody, even with good intention, can do it for someone. The butterfly had to go through its thing. And I think what we can do is, I think that, you know, as a generation down, two generations down, children of the Holocaust, as someone, as a member of the Come Teach Me tribe, as a cancer survivor, as a student of all paths, I have to have a commitment to not vanish, to be visible, to love, like this, you know, the art challenge is to be human and authentic and report our experience and to stay visible and to love like the sun. You know, the sun emanates light and warmth in all directions without preference. What a teacher. What a teacher. And the inner heart that's so embedded with our spirit, our soul, is like an inner sun. And arch courage, the quiet courage, as Mother Teresa said, we courage is doing small things with love. Our courage to help each other to love like the sun. Because when we love like the sun, then what happens? Then we love that other person out of the cave. And just like plants, what do? Trees, plants, fruit, flowers, they all grow to the light. Well, if we love, then we will grow to each other. We can't help it. But I can't persuade, convince, or demonstrate to someone who has a hardened heart. All I can do is soften that hardness by being visible, courageous, and loving, and not vanishing. We cannot go away.
And are you convinced that in spite of the general malaise that exists in at least our society, and certainly far more democratic societies, can't speak for any others, those that seem to have elected officials also have an overwhelming lack of faith anymore in those officials? What do we do about that?
Well, I think actually, you know, I think what we're seeing on the one side is accurate, but I also think there's an equal on the other side that is growing. It's just like all these stories, and why I put them together is because why didn't I learn these stories in school? Why wasn't I taught about these things? Why did I have to wait until my 60s to spend 13 years to discover them? They're there. And the same thing, I am terrifically heartened by the next generation and by people there are people who are coming together. There are people who have faith, and they're not getting all the attention. And that's what I mean about they and us needing to remain visible. I don't have to compete with the other views. I just simply have to be present and wholehearted. And I do believe that, you know, there's just countless examples and stories. You know, I'm blessed I spend a lot of my time traveling around teaching and convening circles or teaching at conferences or speaking. And you know, I am seeing, you know, just amazing people in the upcoming generation that really are just, I'm just so heartened, you know, by this.
I love to hear that kind of optimism. And I hear it often, not just on the air from authors, but from the general public. I do hear that, and it makes me feel, of course, you have to understand, I'm an Irishman, so there's a certain DNA optimism that exists. But also, you were talking about the sun and the curative powers of the warmth. The sun shone on me with an unbelievable depth and warmth one time in my life, in a life filled with sunshine. I was in the company of Mother Teresa and had an audience with her that was unforgettable. And I asked, as a veteran broadcaster would, in welcoming her to my community with her convent of three nuns in a most inhospitable neighborhood in the community. That's where she wanted them to live, and that's where they would do their work. So, but because of that, and because it was just this little this little ramshackle house that was made ready for them. I said, Mother Teresa, tell me, I have a radio audience that I'm going to be talking to. So you tell me to tell them what you need. And I thought, as would be fairly predictable with most people involved with charity and needs, she would say something about, well, we're always thrilled anytime that anybody makes a contribution to our convent, our good sisters here. Or she would say, well, you know, to tell you the truth, we would love to have linoleum or a rug or anything at all I was expecting, because they had nothing. And instead, Mark, she said to me, unforgettably, I'll tell you what to tell your radio audience, Pat. Tell them to go out tomorrow morning and find someone that has no one and love them.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
And, Mark, it was as simple as that. It was simply that basic lesson. But in
itself. Well, and you know what? Yeah, it's just beautiful and amazing. And, you know, and I think that, for me, I learned so deeply in when I was in, and this really is, I guess, my experiential heart of the community book back in the waiting rooms and treatment rooms when I was going through cancer. And, you know, the people that I met, the strangers that I met that became intimate people that I loved in those rooms, because there we were on a raft, before eternity. There we were, and you're sitting next to someone and you say, hi, you know, how you doing? I'm scared. Me too. And, you know, all of a sudden you're loving each other and helping each other. And I was closer to some of those people than I've ever been to other people. And I didn't even know their last names, where they lived, what they did. But we knew the deepest things about each other.
And those people, as did you at that moment, were also experiencing the zenith of need, the need for caring and the need for medical help and the need for good advice. But what do you say to those who don't think they need anyone or anything?
Well, let's bring this up, because those people who are struggling, we see throughout history, it's not true. It's not true. And it's interesting because, you know, again, I don't believe you can convince someone that only their own experience and their own love and suffering, and some of the greatest stories in literature are about this turn, this transformation that happens to all people. I'll tell you, you know, a couple here, but let me focus on a couple of words here first. So this is throughout history, you know, words erode like boulders in weather. And so often I find that the origins of words are much more instructive. So in the book I talk about that the word idiot didn't originally mean someone stupid. The word idiot goes back to the Greek idios, and it meant someone so collapsed upon themselves, mm-hmm. that they were isolated from the rest of the village or tribe or town or community. So the village idiot was not a stupid state. It was a sorrowful state. Mm-hmm. It was someone so isolated out of their pain and fear that they collapsed unto themselves. And that's what an idiot was. The same thing with the word schizoid, which goes back to a word schizos, which is Polish, which means a similar thing. Someone so isolated from their others that they've lost their way. And that's the root of those words. So here here's a very touching story to me about, which is about the philosopher Nietzsche.
Yes.
Now, you know, I read Nietzsche in college, like so many people, but I didn't, you know, I ran across this quote from him many years later and realized, and the quote was so out of keeping of what I had learned about him that it made me say, well, there's got to be a story behind the story. So the quote was, he said, later in life, he said, I want to see what is necessary as beautiful, so I can be one of those who makes things beautiful.
Mm.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm.
I want to see what is necessary as beautiful, so I can be one of those who makes things beautiful.
And it doesn't sound like something that one would associate with Nietzsche. Philosophically, we don't think of him saying something that is that moving.
No, because his early work is all about will, and I'm going to impose my will on destiny, and I'm going to, you know, the Superman. So I said, well, how does this go together? Well, as I looked into the story of Nietzsche's life, yes, the first part of his life, he wrote about all that. And he lived to be 54, but at the age of 44, he had what we would call a breakdown. What happened? Well, as best we know, he was in Turin, Italy, and he was in a hotel on a square, on a palazzo, and he looked out one morning, and he heard this ruckus, and he saw a man whipping a horse. And who knows what happened to him, Pat, but it cracked him. And he ran out into the square saying, stop, you can't just keep whipping this horse. And of course, the man, you know, said, well, it's my horse, I'll do what I want, who are you? And so Nietzsche threw his arms around the horse and put himself between the whip and the whipped. And he was never the same. And after that, he had this breakdown, which no one really could understand what happened to him. And as he recovered, he began to write in an entirely different way in the last 10 years of his life. He started to write about what he called the fate of recurrence. And now he was writing about surrendering to greater wills than our own. Now he was writing about being open to love. And that's when he wrote this amazing quote. And I say to you, so, you know, as a way to speak to what do we say, or what do we do with people who are so isolated or fearful, I think we hold them in our hearts and pray for them and not vanish and be who we are. And, you know, because I believe that is an amazing story where I believe for all the brilliance of mind and the amazing things that Nietzsche wrote, that moment where he threw his arms around the horse, when he stood between the whip and the whipped, that was the poem of his life. And you have people who have invested so much of their philosophical careers, you know, looking at this in history and saying, oh, well, forget everything that Nietzsche wrote after that. Forget that, you know, he lost it. But then you have someone like the great mystic Maya Baba from India who wrote, he said, oh, no, forget everything Nietzsche wrote before that. That was his transformation. That was he didn't lose it. He found it.
Wow. I want you to help us, though, before we run out of time, with a couple of other areas that were so meaningful on a personal basis, too, to me in the book More Together Than Alone. Mark Nepo is our guest on The God Show. At this moment, whenever this moment is, anywhere in the world that somebody happens to be listening to this program, either live Sunday morning at 8 o'clock this coming Sunday with its first broadcast, or then in perpetuity, if you are near a border, then you understand the desperate needs. Whether you agree without a handle of the desperate needs on the other side of the border and the desperate anxiety and frustration of those of us on this side of the border, how to handle that. And there's a part of this book that, by its very title, speaks to that. The courage to take others in. Pursue that for a couple of minutes, if you will, Mark.
Yeah, so, you know, it's so upsetting, this retreat that's currently, you know, by our current administration, about immigrants. And it is, you know, it's very fascist. It's very fascist in its tone and its underpinnings. And, you know, we have always, everyone who's ever lived on Earth is an immigrant. We're an immigrant.
Say that again, Mark. Say that again. I want everybody who might have been going to the refrigerator at that moment to hear.
Everyone who's ever lived on Earth is an immigrant. First, we're immigrants from the spiritual into the physical. Next, we're immigrants, you know, anytime anyone, from Native Americans to how this country was formed by, you know, people coming from England and breaking away from, you know, from the English monarchy. Everyone, it's a story of immigration and a story of whether we welcome each other or not, because the true home is in each other's hearts.
Is the answer to just open up the borders? No country does that.
You know, I don't know what the answer is in terms of policy. I just know that I am a product of immigration, and that those people, the Statue of Liberty was based on welcoming your tired and your poor and your huddled masses yearning to be free, and that we should open up and let in as many people as we can and learn how to live together. The answer is not to push people away, but to welcome people and learn how to live together. And there are great examples, you know, in this current, I talk about in the book, that in this current crisis, you know, before the book came out, it was going on, but in Texas, when all these children, thousands of children had come into Texas, and no one knew what to do with them. And there was all talk of sending them back. This is before Trump was elected. And, you know, and there was this amazing judge in Texas, I have it in the book, who sent out, he wouldn't, you know, put these kids, lock them up or send them back. And he put out a plea, and across seven states, people started taking these kids in as foster kids. They just started taking them into their homes. And if you go back further, in World War II, there's an amazing story known as the Kindertransport.
Oh, yes.
Which means the transporting.
But share it with the audience, please.
Yeah. So, you know, and this is in the late 30s, just, you know, when Hitler was coming to power and it was becoming clear there was a dark cloud over humanity, and especially over Jews and German Jews. And there were about 3,000 to 4,000 Jewish families in Germany who sensed what was coming, and they were desperately looking for a way to save their children, not even themselves. And so through all back channels and underground, they had made contact with people, ordinary people, not rich aristocrats, ordinary people in London and in the outskirts of London in the different parts of England. And yeah, so people said, and they were saying, look, if we send our kids, will you take them? Because otherwise they're going to die. And so, you know, these ordinary people said, oh, yeah, sure, I guess so. You know, I don't know what we'll do. So then there was this whole plan where there was an actual train that took about 2,000 children. And imagine these parents telling their children, well, we'll be on the next train. We'll see you soon,
yes,
knowing in their hearts they'll never see them again. And these kids, imagine these kids not speaking English, coming from speaking German, okay, they're anywhere from 4 to 14, and they're sent on this train. And they land in England, and, you know, there's a coal miner's family, and they take in a girl, and there's somebody else, you know, a shoemaker who takes in a boy. And all of these 2,000 kids were absorbed in the average population through no program, through no, you know, organized and figured out, funded, you know, policy just by the goodness and the hearts of saying, somebody saying, well, we can't really fit another person, but, I don't know. Yeah, okay, we'll bring them in. And then they're sitting there and they're having to learn how to live together, and they're learning how to teach, you know, this young girl English and trying to deal with her grief. Where are my parents? I don't know. Where are they coming? I don't know. But this is your home now.
There is no train from Guatemala. There is no train from Honduras. But there are children who
yes.
are part of a different kind of kinder transport. And
absolutely.
I don't know that any of us do have the policy answer. And I know something else that we don't have. We have altogether so little time, and there's so many things that I really would love to have you talk about. And of course, you can talk to folks, not only in More Together Than Alone, but tell everybody about your recordings.
Well, you know, I have my website, markvipo.com, and a sister website, threeintentions.com. All my books and where I'm speaking and teaching and my recordings are there. And I'm also, which is just up, is you can find out information. I'll be offering 3 spiritual journeys, different formats next year. And there's information on how to, detailed information on how to register for that in the coming year.
What about the online community guide?
Yes, the online community guide, which is available to download, which is in the back of the book, More Together Than Alone, which has questions and invitations for how to journal and be in conversation with small groups right where you live, how to address, first, how to find where these things that we've been talking about live in yourself, and then how to apply them where you live. How to apply them where you live. How to, you know, as we said, you know, Mother Teresa, courage is doing small things with love. What small steps can you take where you live and with what's up in your community, and how to bridge gaps and love like the sun?
Besides all of those problems that we've talked about and the solutions therein, we only have about 8 minutes left, and it's 875 things that I want to talk about. And I guess probably the solution to that would be simply to invite you back to the God Show,
sure.
Which I am right now. But
well, thank you.
Please, if you will, please, if you will, Mark, give me 4 minutes on the other extraordinary problem unique to this country for the most part. And that is the mass shootings that you refer to as a result of social aneurysms.
Well, so you know, one of the things is, and I have no answers, but I do want to frame it this way, and that, you know, throughout the world, these shootings are a modern atrocity. They're a modern plague, but in America, it is an epidemic more than anywhere else in the world. Why is this? So I think that, you know, when we look at these people who conduct this behavior, this horrible behavior, they're accountable. We can say they're crazy, they're broken, they're suffering, whatever. They're still responsible for what they do, the horrible, the harm that they do. And it's not enough for us to say, well, that has nothing to do with me. And how does that come together? And I want to offer this as a biological metaphor to understand it, and that's of an aneurysm. So an aneurysm, we know, is a cell in a body, in a pressurized body. So you have a weak cell, and when a body, like the blood pressure of the body through illness or pain or trauma, is so high that weak cell explodes, and that usually leads to a stroke of some kind. Well, I want to offer that these people are social aneurysms. They are weak souls, weak cells, whatever the reason, in that. But we have created a social body that is so pressurized that we have an epidemic of weak souls exploding. So, yes, these people are accountable for the horrible things they do, but it is our job to depressurize. How is our society so pressurized that we have an epidemic of these weak cells and souls exploding everywhere you turn? That's our job. And I think that some of the ways we get at that are some of the things we've been talking about. How do we listen to each other's stories? How do we love like the sun? How do we listen to the stories of our enemies until they no longer become our enemies? You know, and let me leave you with a small poem of mine, very small, that goes like this. The mystery is that whoever shows up when we dare to give has exactly what we need hidden in their trouble.
Mm. Is that your poetry?
Yes, yes. That's from a book called The Way Under the Way, which is 20 years of my poetry. Let me say that again. The mystery is that whoever shows up when we dare to give has exactly what we need hidden in their trouble.
Well, I'm asking for your indulgence then to allow us to meet someone that I met only through the majesty of a part of your book. And I would love to have you end our program with only 4 minutes to go by introducing our audience on The God Show to that little boy in Italy.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, at the end of the book, I, after all 13 years of looking and trying to understand and reading and listening to people in real time, I kept coming back to this photograph taken by David Seymour. He was known as Chim, an amazing war photographer from World War II. And he was sent, I saw it in New York at the International Center of Photography, and it's the photograph after, in the ruins of Italy after World War II, of a blind, armless boy, maybe 8 or 9 years old, and he's in the sun learning to read Braille with his lips. And after all of these stories and all of this trying to understand things, I kept coming back to that photograph because, yes, on the surface it's sad, but the more I went back to it, it's not just sad, it's resilient, and it's just awe-inspiring of the human spirit. And that, you know, we are all these things. We do it all. We are the ones who create the war. We're the ones who end the war. We're the ones who clean up after the war. We're the ones who teach and put that book in front of that boy's lips. We are the boy. And we're the witness who takes the picture of this life coming alive yet again, that this innate need in us to be more together than alone, to learn, to love, to just grow no matter what. We will even learn how to read Braille with our lips, even when we don't have arms. To me, that boy became a symbol of everything, no matter where I went, and a symbol of us being more together than alone.
It's a part of the last few pages of More Together Than Alone by Mark Nepo. You know, even when I have authors on, as we more often than not do, talking about the spiritual relationship of man as an entity on this planet, I don't do this very often because I leave it up to the audience to be interested or not, but I can't tell you how much better your library is going to be if you get a copy of this. More Together Than Alone, Discovering the Power and Spirit of Community in Our Lives and in the World. And Mark Nepo, with 1 minute to go, I contend here and now, you think we're going to be okay, don't you?
Yes, I do. I don't think it's going to be easy, but I certainly do.
Why?
Well, for all the things we've talked about, because the human spirit, that is the spirit that we are blessed to contain for the time that we're here, is irrepressible and unbreakable. We, the containers, we can break and we suffer. But that portion of universal spirit that we are blessed to carry and steward for the brief time we're here, that is irrepressible and unbreakable.
And how delightful experience it is for all of us who are associated with this program to have constructed the stage. That's pretty much what it is, a stage that the curtain is pulled every day, almost constantly, for audiences around the world on the Star Worldwide Networks with guests like Mark Nepo. And I'm your host, Pat McMahon, on The God Show.